This is the Read, Write, and Create podcast, the podcast where you get a bite-sized session of creative writing coaching from me, Lori L. Tharps. I'm an award-winning author of both fiction and nonfiction, a journalist, and a former college professor. I've spent more than 20 years writing, teaching, and coaching creative writers, so I created this podcast because I want to help as many BIPOC writers as possible get their stories out of their heads and into the world. Are you ready? Let's go. On episode 29 of the podcast, I am so excited to have New York Times bestselling author Sadiqua Johnson join me on the show to share her story and her strategies to achieve bestseller status as a novelist whose stories always center the lives of Black women. In case you didn't know, Sadiqua Johnson is the New York Times bestselling author of 5 novels, including Yellow Wife and her latest, The House of Eve, which was the February 2023 Reese Witherspoon Book Club selection. Sadiqua's accolades also include being an NAACP Image Award nominee, a 2022 Hurston Wright Foundation Legacy finalist, a BCALA Literary Honoree, and the Library of Virginia's Literary People's Choice Award winner. She's a Cambilio Fellow, and Sadiqua teaches in the MFA program at Drexel University. Originally from Philadelphia, she currently lives near Richmond, Virginia, with her husband and 3 teenage children. Now, you are in for such a treat because during our inspiring and educational conversation, Sadiqua takes us all the way back to the beginning of her journey as an author when she was hand-selling her self-published novel because she couldn't get a book deal with a traditional publisher, all the way to her current status with the title New York Times bestselling author attached to her name. During our conversation, we talk about her spirit-led journey from penning contemporary novels to tackling serious historical fiction. And Sadiqua shares her honest thoughts about being considered a crossover success story in the literary world. Throughout our uplifting discussion, Sadiqua also shares her practical strategies for staying published and top of mind in today's marketplace. Spoiler alert, it has nothing to do with social media and everything to do with sitting down every day and writing. So grab a cup of tea or lace up your sneakers for a good long walk and get prepared to be inspired to keep writing with Sadiqua Johnson. Welcome to the Read, Write, and Create podcast, Sadiqua Johnson.
Thank you, Lori. It's so wonderful to be here. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, I am super happy to have you. And I know my listeners are super happy to have you because they've already told me that you are like the fan favorite of the members of the Sanctuary and a lot of listeners who got really excited when I told them that you were going to be on the podcast. And I always like to actually start by sharing why I'm excited to have my guests on the podcast. And the reason I wanted you to be on the show is because I think of you as like the professional novelist. And personally, I feel like somebody who has had the success that you have had with successive novels is, it almost feels like it's not even possible in today's literary landscape, particularly as a Black woman writer. The fact that you write both contemporary fiction and historical fiction, it's such an inspirational story. And you seem like such a normal person. It's like, it's like, how is she doing it? You're a mother of 3. We have watched you go from like the beginning to this place where you are today, where I feel like you are one of our top novelists to be one of us. That's what it is like. You know, it feels like you could be everybody's best friend. And yet again, the work that you've done is truly remarkable. So that's why I'm excited to have you here. And I know everybody wants me to stop talking and let's get into your story. So first question, I read somewhere that you actually originally wanted to be an actress. So can you tell the people how you went from wanting to be an actress to becoming a novelist? We'll do it in segments, but can you share with us how, you know, it started there and then morphed into something different?
Well, first, I just have to respond to your beautiful opening. All of that really warms my heart. I mean, thank you. I just needed to say that. Like that just, you know, when it's you, it doesn't really feel like all the things that you said. So I just wanted to say thank you for that. All right. To answer your question, yes, I started off wanting to be an actress. I was in love with The Cosby Show and A Different World. I went to college in New York City. I went to Marymount Manhattan College, but I did not go to school to graduate. I went to college in New York City to be discovered. I had read that Erica Alexander went to, I believe it was NYU, and she was there for 2 weeks. She was discovered. She got onto The Cosby Show as Cousin Pam, and then the rest was her story, right? And so I thought, yep, that's exactly what I'm going to do. So I went to Marymount. I was a theater major for the first year, no discovery. Second year, still a student. By the third year, I started to think, well, goodness gracious, if I'm going to do this acting thing, I'm going to need a job to support me. So maybe I should switch to communication so that when I graduate from college, I could at least get a job. So I did that. I switched to communications, graduated in 4 years, still not discovered, and was waiting tables for a little bit and decided, like, I have a degree, a whole degree. You know, my parents paid a lot for this. I cannot be like the struggling actress waiting tables. I need to get a job. What things do I love? I love to read. Great. I'm going to look for a job in publishing. And I got my very first job at Scholastic Books. My thought was I would go to work, and because it was in New York City, I would schedule all of my auditions during lunchtime or after work. And so that is what I did for the first year or two. And so it just became increasingly obvious that the universe did not have a plan for me to actually star on Broadway or be on A Different World Part Two.
That's, I'm laughing so hard because I secretly lived that same exact life. Only I wasn't even smart enough to go to New York. I went to school in Western Massachusetts, where it'd be really hard for anybody to quote unquote discover me. But I too thought Bill Cosby would pluck me off. I must have read the Erica Alexander story too, because I literally thought every time I went to New York, Bill Cosby himself, you know, this is pre-Bill Cosby being Bill Cosby, but I thought that he would just see me and know that I really wanted to be an actress. So I'm laughing in really like shared sisterhood in that. So you're working at Scholastic, which is a great place to land. I mean, it seems like a fun place to work. Was it fun? And is that where the idea of you actually starting to write as well came from?
Absolutely. So I was working at Scholastic and took the job in publicity. And as I was working, I was always getting, you know, all these books, meeting these different authors. And I had been, you know, like most authors, I was a crazy reader at a very early age. When I was in middle school, I went to the library like once a week, checked out 7 books, read a book a day, and then went back again, right? So I was always consuming books. So when I got to publishing, I thought, well, I'm always reading. I was always writing poetry. When I was a theater major, we had to write screenplays and plays and that sort of thing. So I was interested, but I didn't know that I was a writer at that point. So when I was working in publishing, I started to fool around with children's books because it was a children's publisher. And I thought, oh, my childhood was sort of kind of interesting. Let me make up stories that my sisters and I used to make up as a kid, and I'll try and write that. And so that was sort of the beginning of maybe I'll write a little bit. And then I gradually thought, well, I love novels. Maybe I should try to write a little novel. So I was taking some writing classes on the side. But yes, working within a publishing house sort of gave me that bug of go ahead and try to write a novel.
I was going to ask you, like, were you taking classes on the side? So you were, and you're in New York City, so that's easier than it is in other places, because it's like there's a writing school or writing workshops kind of all over the place where you can do that. Did you ever doubt that that was something you could do, or you just were like, it just was so normal because you were in that environment?
It felt pretty normal because I was meeting writers on a regular basis. And I kind of had a few moments where I would think, well, if them, why not me? Like, if they could do it, why not me? And I, you know, I'm reading the books, I'm meeting the people, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, it doesn't seem so far-fetched that I could do this. And I felt like because I was working within the scopes of the publishing house, that I had a little bit more connections than, say, just a regular writer. I started at Scholastic, but a few years later, I went over to G.P. Putnam's Sons and Riverhead Books, which was fully adult books, fully nonfiction and fiction books. And so there, I really could see how the dream could be manifested.
And that's the, you know, when people always say you can't do it if you don't see it. And here you were, again, not with this, like, I'm going to be a writer since I was 5 years old. But once something becomes normalized for you, I love it that your response was, I mean, I'm no different from these other people. Why not me? I love that. So I know your first book, Love in a Carry-On Bag, was self-published originally. Tell us how that book came to be. And I might be wrong, but I know that it was self-published originally, but did it eventually get picked up by a major publisher? Tell us the life cycle of that book.
When I was working at Putnam, that was really when I started working on Love in a Carry-On Bag. And I remember having, and this is for our writers out there, it is really important to have a writing schedule, particularly when you have a job. And so my writing schedule was, I caught the train into New York City from New Jersey at that point. And so I would write in the morning on the train. And then every day at 4 o'clock, I would close my office door and pretend like I was working on something for work. But that last hour from 4 to 5 was my writing time. And it was that time because I didn't have a printer at home. And so this was back in the day when we had those big share printers in the office. And so I would have to run over to the printer, grab my manuscript off, and then I would edit it on my train ride back to New Jersey every day. So that was sort of my weekly writing schedule. I was always with authors. As a publicist, it was my job to take them to the Today Show and Good Morning America and Barnes & Noble. And so I was constantly picking their brain. What's your writing schedule like? How did you get an agent? Where do you get your ideas? I was asking all those questions that we as writers want to know. So I felt pretty prepared. I knew editors, I knew agents. And I had gotten married during this process and we were having our first child. So I told my husband, I said, I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to have our son and I'm going to be a New York Times bestselling author. And all he heard was, you gonna quit your job? And I was like, yes, yes, don't worry. It's all gonna work out. And so I quit my job. I had my son, but I was not able to get a publishing deal. So I was able to get an agent who was really reputable in the business. And again, it happened fairly quickly that I got the agent because of my connection to publishing. But when she took my book out to market, one by one, at least 9 editors told me no. The 10th editor said that she was interested in my book, but she needed to talk to her boss and she would get back to me by that following Monday. And I just remember at this point, Lori, I have 3 children. So this is how long it took for me. So this was not an overnight sort of thing. And so I remember very clearly because the kids were little and we were all dancing in the kitchen and it was like, mommy's about to have a book deal. Like, yes. Well, that Monday, my agent called and she's like, Sadiqua, I am so sorry. She was like, as much as she loved the book, she couldn't get it greenlit. And so we're going to have to wait 6 months and we'll give it another try. But as I said, I was pregnant with the first child. Now we got 3 little people looking up at me. And there's still no book deal. There's still no book out in the world. No one knows my name, right? So my husband and I had to have a really hard conversation because at this point I was really down in the dumps. I was really feeling like what? What am I supposed to do? And I remember putting my kids in the double stroller and sort of going to this lake in my neighborhood and crying out for a vision. Like, God, what is it? What am I supposed to do? And my husband and I went out to dinner that night and he said, what do you need? And I said, I need an editor. And he said, why don't we just hire an editor? And it was almost like in that moment, my brain opened up because I was very specific about how I wanted this thing to go. I wanted it to look like it did when I worked in the publishing house. I wanted what all the other authors had, right? But that wasn't the plan. And so I had to make that shift. And once I did, it was like everything that I needed came. I was able to hire an editor who is now my fabulous agent, who I could not live without, Sharice Fisher. And distribution, marketing, like everything sort of started to come. And with my background in publishing, I became the sales manager. So I would call up the local bookstores with an alias and pitch my own book to them and try to get them to carry my book. So it was a hustle. We literally spent, the book came out in 2012. We spent that first year going up and down the East Coast with retractables and tables and going to every book festival and every hair show and every anything where I knew that Black women were going to be, that I could stand in front of and I could hand sell them my book. And that was my first year as an author. I was standing on cobblestone streets until the bottom of my feet hurt. I sweated off my makeup on most occasions, but I just kept showing up.
I'm like, woo, that's such a good story. I mean, not the painful parts for you, but I mean, because we know how it ends, it is such a great story. And I'm so glad you are willing to share it. You know, for all the writers listening who haven't gotten that break yet, who haven't gotten that agent yet, that doesn't mean that your book isn't worthy. It doesn't mean that it's not really good. It means that there's another path for it to get out into the world. And that's something that I'm really stressing for my writers, is that your stories need to get out into the world by any means necessary. And that doesn't mean putting out bad work, because if it needs to be edited or it needs some refinement, that's one thing. But we're not going to let gatekeepers decide whether or not our work makes it out into the world, because there are multiple ways for that to happen. And lucky for you that you did have that publishing background, so you could pretend to be other people, like you knew the distribution channels, you knew where to go. But I would love to just hear just a, I really wasn't going to ask you this part yet, but you mentioned hair shows. And back in the day, when I worked at Entertainment Weekly, I remember writing a story about Black authors using hair shows as promotional venues. Talk a little bit about how diverse you had to be in your venues and thinking about where to sell your book.
I mean, it literally was anywhere that I could afford a booth. I knew that there was going to be foot traffic. And most often, I was the only book seller at some of these events. So hair shows and, I mean, any type of trade show, any type of All About You Day or, you know, community service, whatever, like anything where it was like a booth was $75 to $150, I would think, okay, I need to sell this amount of books in order for the booth to pay itself, and then the rest would be profit. It was always like hair and jewelry and makeup and pottery and then me. And so I came with the thunder. I had the retractables and I would always stand in front of my table. And so this is the tip, right? Whenever I go to the National Black Book Conference, Curtis Buntz Conference in Atlanta, there are always a bunch of booths, people selling books. But the authors are sitting behind the table waiting for someone to approach them. My trick was I would stand in front of the table, sort of next to the retractable. So as you're walking by and you see this big retractable that says Love in a Carry-On Bag, I'm putting a book in your hand. And as I'm putting the book in your hand, I'm telling you what the book is about. So I'm already halfway there because you're holding my product and then I'm selling it to you. So that was sort of my trick. I would always have like some sort of peppermints or something like that on my table to get people to stop and pick one up as they were listening to me. And that helped a lot. That really helped a lot. And that was really the beginning for me of that sort of hand selling, foot traffic type of work.
And we're going to come back to that because I'm sure that never actually ends in today's market. You're still having to sell, even if you have a big name behind you. So then what happened so that your next two books, I think you got a two book deal after that. How does that happen then? So tell us what, you know, your kids are like, yay, mommy's selling her book. You've been, you know, hitting the streets, doing it all by yourself. And I know today a lot of people are still getting advice like don't self-publish. If you self-publish, a major publisher will never publish it for you. So how did it happen for you?
What happened was my editor at the time who I hired with Sharice Fisher, we kind of were moving at the time where she said, I'm going to help you find an agent. I know some people. It turns out that she pitched me to a few agents and, you know, they came back and said what they did. But we sort of looked at each other and I said, Charisse, no one loves me the way you do. You need to be my agent. Because at that point, she had already been more than just an editor that I hired. And I think at the same time, she was thinking she was ready for a change. And so we went into it together. I was her first client, you know, that sort of thing. And she was able to partner with another agency. And when they pitched me to the major publishing houses, it was just really a phenomenal experience because having had nobody wanting to buy Love in a Carry-On bag to now I'm walking literally into publishing houses with my team, pitching my book, pitching me, telling them who I am. It turned out that three major publishing houses wanted to purchase my second book, which is called Second House from the Corner. And I ended up selling it to St. Martin's Press because one of the things Charisse said to me as we were going into the meetings is, you've already self-published a book pretty successfully. So I want you to be listening to what these editors are saying. What's different? What can they give you different than you've already done for yourself? And what St. Martin's Press offered was a 2-book hardcover deal. And I sold them the book that I had already written and the one that was kind of in the back of my brain, which is something we can talk about. I don't know that I would ever do that again, but that's what I did at that point. And that was sort of the beginning of my career as being traditionally published.
You just said something that I want to emphasize for our listeners. When you met with these publishers, you sold them your next book that you had already written. Talk to us a little bit about that, that while you were hustling, selling Love in a Carry-On bag, were you also already writing the next book? And in your mind, what were you thinking? Like, I'm writing the next book that I'm going to have to self-publish again? Or were you like, whatever happens? Or were you like, this next one is going to be the one that really gets me my deal?
I knew that self-publishing was a short stint for me. It wasn't in my plan. It was sort of the way to get to what I wanted, which was, you know, social media had just started around the time, or I had just discovered social media at that point. And so I had no platform going into Love in a Carry-On bag. So I had just started to build my Facebook presence at that time and my newsletter presence and all of that. And so I was doing all of that so that I could go back to the major publishing houses with Second House from the Corner. I've always had a writing schedule. Even when I was home with my kids, my schedule was when they were at school. So I would drop them off, I would write, and then I would get them in the evenings, or that would be it. Or if I had a baby at home, I had a 15-year-old, her name was Brittany. She used to come to my house every day and she would watch the kids from 4 to 6. And I would go into my basement office and I would work on my novel for just those 2 hours a day. So it really depends, but I always had a schedule. I always had a plan. And so I was constantly working on Second House from the Corner so that I would be ready to go back to the publishing house. So that was the plan. And thank gosh, it happened this time.
And, you know, I was going to ask this a little bit later, but I think it also bears pointing out that there's more than one way to build an audience. The word now is platform. What's your platform? But people need to understand that what publishers really mean is how many people are just going to automatically buy your book so we don't have to do any work selling it. Like, we just want to know that you come built in with an audience. And too many people assume that platform or audience means social media followers, because that's become the shorthand for defining your audience. When in fact, we know that having a certain number of followers on social media does not translate to book sales. On the other hand, if you got 10,000 people to buy your self-published book, they'll probably buy your next book. That is an actual better sign of how many people will buy your book. Because just because I will hit like on something that I saw on social media for 5 seconds, that's zero commitment. That is zero promise that these people will buy your book. So it's actually just another way. And we're going to dial back to that in a moment. Like, I want to talk a little bit more about, you know, what does it take to sell a book in 21st century? But I just think that's interesting for people to think about, that there's more than one way to prove that you have an audience. It's not only social media. And the other point that I want to point out is that, did you hear Sadiqua say, I was still writing. I had 3 babies and I still found time, or I should say I made time, she said, to always be writing. That should be on a t-shirt. Always be writing. That's what we do. We always be writing all the time.
Well, because also, I don't know if you feel like this, Lori, but for me, when I'm not writing, I am cranky. My day is not going well. It's like I have not had that release. I have not done what I said I was going to do. I did not show up for my work. And when that is happening, unless I am specifically saying I am on vacation or I am on book tour, and while on book tour, I'm not really planning to write, you know, unless I'm specific about that. Otherwise, I could just feel it in my body that something is wrong.
So one of the things that I really appreciate about your career is that looking at your books, it's almost like we see the evolution of a writer, where your stories, not to say that writing historical fiction is more complicated, but I think it is. Like, I don't want to like dismiss at either side, because I'm sure writing, you know, contemporary fiction is its own challenge. But I just feel like your books have gone from, I feel like Yellow Wife was a true feat because it's based on a real character. It's, you know, historical. There's that idea of how much do we stick to reality? How much do we make up? It's a deep project that you did. And so I just want to know, from your point of view, how would you describe your growth as a writer? Was it intentional? Was it just, you know, every time it just gets a little better? Or are you actively doing things to improve your craft?
The jump from And Then There Was Me, which was my third novel, my third contemporary fiction, to Yellow Wife was huge on a lot of levels. One, we were living in Springfield, New Jersey, and I remember standing in my kitchen and I heard a voice that said, move. We were already looking for a new house, but this move wasn't like move to Bergen County or move to, you know, Sussex County. It was like, no, move out of the state. And I can't really explain it, but there was no real rhyme or reason. The feeling happened in February, and by June, we had moved to Virginia. It happened fast. There were no glitches in the plan. And it was 9 months from that point that I was on the Richmond Slave Trail, and I discovered the story of Mary Lumpkin, who was the inspiration behind Yellow Wife. And as I learned her story, I could feel the hairs on my arm stand up. I knew that this woman's story needed to be told because I hadn't heard of her, and I knew people needed to know who she was, but I didn't think that I was the person to tell the story. I wanted to read it, but I didn't think that I could write it because I had no experience. I thought to be a historical fiction writer, you needed, I don't know, a history degree or something I didn't have. It just didn't feel like it was supposed to be me. But at the same time, it was almost as if the ancestors were on that slave trail waiting for me. They wanted me to tell their story. It was like a calling. And when I looked into my family history, my people are from Virginia. My husband's people are from Virginia. And so that strong feeling that I felt was almost like they were calling me home to tell this story. So once I got up the courage, because it took a lot of courage, it was so scary to change lanes. I thought, would the 100 people who had bought my previous novels, would they follow me into this new genre? Could I pull it off? All of the things. It was a major career shift. But one of my friends had said to me, when I was telling her all these things and how afraid I was, she said, Sadiqua, the thing that scares you most is what you're supposed to be doing next. And that just gave me a little crack in the window to say the very least I can do with this project is give it a try. And it was very different. You know, the other books, I didn't have to research. If I'm completely honest, when you're writing contemporary fiction, you're putting yourself all up and through every page, right? Like your experiences, your family, things you hear at the coffee shop, all of those things are happening in your contemporary fiction. But when you're writing a story that takes place over 100 years before you were born, that's a whole different skill set that I had to develop. But it's one that I'm really grateful for because I realized that my calling as a writer has shifted. And not only am I supposed to tell stories, but I've been called to shine a light in dark spaces in history and bring those stories to the forefront, specifically with Black women at the subject. You know, our history is so rich, but we only get the Martin Luther Kings and the Rosa Parks. There's so many other stories that we know nothing about. And so my charge is to educate through historical fiction, but also entertain, because I think the fiction makes it sweeter. No one wants to read a textbook. You want a good story, and then you want to go and look up all the things the author said, and then you learn something. And so I found that is sort of the sweet spot of what my purpose right now is.
That's, you know, I get very deep and spiritual about our responsibilities as African American storytellers, as Native storytellers, as storytellers from the global majority, because our stories have so long been undervalued, hidden, and erased. And so I do see this as a calling and a necessity. And so what you just said, like the fact that your ancestors called you to tell this story that needed to be told, is beautiful. I feel like if you pull back a little bit and you see your career, and it's like almost every step you see that it was leading you to this place. It's like, I had to do this first, then I had to do this, and this all makes sense. And here I am exactly where I'm supposed to be right now. And also for the writers listening, Sadiqua said that this was a shift for her and it was scary, but this is how we evolve as writers. Like, we're not necessarily, and no disrespect to the people who do write 21 books of exactly the same type. I mean, hey, if it works for you, people keep buying them, you do you, girl. But we also, as writers, can evolve and start in one genre and switch to another or evolve to a different type of storytelling. So what I wanted to ask then, I know you were joking when you said, will my 100 readers buy this next book? Will they follow me? And obviously, book club fan favorite, you have more than 100 readers. But I do want to know, what was that like for you to, you know, once The Yellow Wife came out, did it shift or change who was reading your books, the types of publicity you got? Talk to us a little bit about that, because I don't even know if this term is used, like crossover success or mainstream, you know. Did it feel like you had hit a crossover success level with The Yellow Wife?
That would be probably the best way that I would describe it, is that Yellow Wife definitely crossed me over into other groups, you know. Now I have white women who want me to come to their book clubs and talk about the books in a way that I didn't for Second House from the Corner and Then There Was Me. It also came out during, Yellow Wife came out in 2020. So we were in the midst of COVID, in the midst of the social uprising. We were in the midst of everybody now wants to be woke. And so not only just Black people wanting to discover the roots of our history, but now we have white people who are like, I never knew. Please educate me. Tell me more. Tell me more. And so I was sort of getting readers on both sides, which, you know, is great, right? For book sales and awareness and all of that. And that was definitely the beginning of my numbers ticking up, because not only did I have Black women's support, I had everybody's support with this book.
And then you don't stop there. The Book of Eve Reese Witherspoon chooses your book for her book club, which is, I feel like, the biggest way to say, like, I have made it in the mainstream of America. I'm very curious, what happens when Reese Witherspoon, you know, selects your book? Is it Oprah 90s kind of life-changing thing? Or what does that feel like for an author?
Well, for me, when Reese Witherspoon selects your book, you fulfill your lifetime dream of becoming a New York Times bestselling author. I mean, that is what it was like for me, because all the way back to Loving to Carry On Back, my first book, the goal, the dream was always to make the list. And once The House of Eve was a Reese Witherspoon pick, my publisher, the language changed around my marketing and my publicity. And they started whispering, our goal is New York Times bestseller, which that had not happened up until that point. That was always my goal, but that was not always, you know, the publisher's goal. But once we had that stamp on the book, then that became everyone's goal. And I was very fortunate to spend 2 weeks on the list.
Congratulations. That is amazing. I'm just curious, like, how did that make you feel that it took a Reese Witherspoon stamp of approval for you to get that kind of respect and push from the publishing industry?
I felt like it was slow and steady wins the race. And it felt appropriate at that point. That's all I can say is that I've been in a place of gratitude. It definitely changed a lot of things for me. It's opened up doors. And I'm really grateful for it.
I have a special fondness for all of Reese's book picks myself. I feel like ever since Oprah retired her show, where it was like, if you got the Oprah stamp of approval, that was such a life-changing thing. And I feel like Reese is kind of taking that mantle. I mean, there are a lot of celebrities have book clubs now, but I feel like Reese's book club really brings authors a whole new level of status. Was there any crazy stories when you actually got the news?
My crazy news was more so just being caught off guard. I think my editor had asked me if I could jump on a Zoom call. And normally, you know, everything is scheduled. So if I'm getting on a Zoom call with my publishing professionals, I look professional. But it was like a hot, muggy September day. And I thought, well, it's just a quick call. I'm not going to go fix myself up. And that was the call, where it was not only my editors, but salespeople and marketing people from Simon & Schuster. Both of my agents were on the call. Some other people who I didn't know, which I found out later, was from the Hello Sunshine team. And, you know, my editor was just like, Sadiqa, we just want to let you know that The House of Eve has been selected as a Reese Witherspoon pick. And the only caveat is Reese wants to move the book up to a February pub, because at that point, the book was coming out in March. And I'm thinking, that's no caveat. Reese could do whatever it is that she needs to do. All right. But that was it. And so it was definitely unexpected in that moment. But I'm also a big believer of visualization and manifestations and seeing yourself as already having it. And I think I have been intending myself as a book club pick for a couple of books. So this was just the manifestation. This was the moment that it materialized. But when I look at my vision boards and I'm thinking about how I visualize myself, I was already in that vibration. It was just waiting for the manifestation to actually happen.
And again, writers, listen up. You have to believe it first so that it can happen. All right, let's shift gears here and talk a little bit about craft. You already told us that you have a writing schedule and you've maintained that writing schedule consistently since day one. I'm wondering if you have any specific writing rituals. Do you light candles? Do you eat chocolate chip cookies while you're writing? Do you put music on in the background? What do you do to set up your writing time?
I'm a morning writer, and I'm very fortunate that this is my full-time job now. So every morning I set my day with prayer and meditation. And prayer and meditation just to get me right, but also to make space for the writing to flow through me. I see myself as the conduit. You know, the story has to flow through me, and my job is to be the typist and to catch it. So I have to prepare my space for that. I often, most times, probably 85 to 90% of the time, I work in my home office. Most times I light a candle before I start writing. And I have, for the book I'm working on now, so every book, I think it changes a bit. In the past, I've written to time. So maybe I'll start the day and say, today I'm going to write 3 hours, or today I'm going to write 5 hours, or whatever that is. And so I'll write to time. And I sign in and sign out, because the internet is a very tricky thing where one email will turn into 5 emails. And before you know it, an hour of your writing time has been gobbled up. And so I literally sign in if it's 7:30. When I get up to go get my coffee or my breakfast, I sign out, whatever that time is, so that I can hold myself accountable. The book that I'm working on now, I've had to change the time, because when you're doing historical fiction, writing is also researching, and researching is a lot easier than writing. And so I was finding that, yeah, I was clocking 4 or 5 hours, but I got like 15 words on the page because I went down several different rabbit holes today. So to keep myself accountable and moving steady, because I do have a contract for this book, I decided to follow my other writer friends who write 2,000 words a day. And when they said that, I'm like, that's absurd. Like, how can you do that? But I started with 2,000 words a day and I was hitting on my marks. And so now for the editing process, I'm trying to edit 7 to 10 pages a day. So if I have those kind of marks for myself to hit, this is what I'm learning about writing. So my book is due December 1st. But in order for me to get to December 1st, I have to have small goals. I have to have bite-sized goals for my day, for my week, and for my month. And when I look at it in those terms, then it makes getting to that December 1st date less scary. So that's what I'm doing. I'm holding myself accountable every step of the way. So my self-imposed deadline for a big chunk of the book is April 30th. And so I worked backwards from there and gave myself an assignment every single day. And once I can check that off, then it's like, okay, I'm on track.
I always reference Octavia Butler's, you know, that writing is about discipline, not about inspiration. You know, it's about just getting yourself in the chair every day. And I like your, you know, that sometimes you can do it to time, sometimes you can do word count, but whatever it is, you kind of have to have that. Otherwise, you could spend hours and not get anything accomplished and not know what happened. I love that. And I love that you check in and check out so you stay accountable. So you just mentioned that the next book is another bit of historical fiction. And that's what the number one question my writers wanted to know. What's she working on next? So it's historical fiction. Can you tell us anything else about it or not yet?
Yeah, I can tell you a little bit about it. Right now, and the publisher broke my heart on The House of Eve and changed my title. So I can give you the title, but it might not stick. Right now, it's called Beautiful Children. And it opens in 1948, and it takes place in Germany during the occupation of Germany, where the Americans went in. But when they went in, there was a lot of Black men who went to Germany during that time, and they fell in love or had relationships with some of the white German women and produced children. And what happened to those children? I'm always, always about the children. So those babies were called war babies. They were called brown babies. They were called occupational babies. And so that's sort of the framing of the story. There's, of course, a whole bunch of other things. I'm doing my regular Sadiqa thing with it, but that is sort of kind of what I'm holding on to. And then everything else is kind of built around there.
Now, you've already kind of given us, in talking about your rituals and your writing schedule, some really useful tips. I'm wondering if you just have a final word of advice for any emerging BIPOC writers who are listening right now. What advice would you give them specifically if they want to write fiction, want to have an actual career writing novels and being traditionally published?
The first advice I would give them is get your butt in the chair. That is where it all starts. It all starts with getting your butt in the chair, giving yourself a writing schedule. If it's 10 minutes before bed, if it's an hour in the morning before you go to your day job, whatever that is, stick to it. I tell my writing students to put it on your calendar the same as you would a dentist appointment. You're not going to not show up for a dentist appointment. So don't not show up for your writing. So that really is where it all begins, is that discipline of showing up 5 days a week. I'm just going to put it out there. It could be 10 minutes. It could be 5 hours, but you should do it Monday through Friday in some form so that you get that momentum. Because what I find for me is when I step away from more than just Saturday and Sunday, I start to lose the momentum. The characters stop speaking to me. It's harder for me to get back to that point where I was. So that would be my first bit of advice. Second is that you really have to trust the process. Like my first book, Loving a Carry-On Bag, took me over 10 years to publish. It was about 8 or 9 drafts that I did on that particular book. Your first book is where you're learning to write. So be patient with yourself. You know, you don't have to write a book in 4 months and then next thing you know, it's with the publisher and all that. Your first book is the only time that you're going to be able to write a book with all the time in the world. And I'm not saying squander that time, but give yourself that time to develop. I took a lot of writing classes in the beginning. I teach a lot of writing classes. Don't be afraid to take a class or get into a group so that you have people who are like you and you guys are all motivating each other to keep going. And writing is scary. It really is. Like I often think it is probably easier to go to law school and become an attorney or be a doctor. Maybe people who are going to law school and becoming doctors would disagree. But from my vantage point, that's how it feels, right? It's not easy. But the more you show up for it, the more you'll be rewarded.
And again, there's no easy way around it. There's no cheat code. It's just showing up every single day. I love this. This has been such an inspirational, like your story is inspirational. Your advice is inspirational. And like I started, I feel like you're my best friend and you just gave me best friend advice on how I can be a better writer. And I hope everybody listening feels the same way. Sadiqua, where can everybody find you and your wonderful advice and encouragement on the internet?
I've been primarily spending my time on Instagram because it's really hard to keep up with all these platforms. So another advice is pick one or two and stick with it. It is, to me, impossible to stick with all of them. So I spend most of my time on Instagram and you can find me at Sadiqua Says. You can go to my website, sadiqua.net. And when you do, please subscribe to my newsletter so that we can keep in touch. My newsletter is a lot more personal than my social media posts, but I would love to hang out with you. And I do meet with book clubs. So reach out to me and I'm happy to do that.
Wonderful. And of course, we'll put all of Sadiqua's links in the show notes. And again, that's, I know I said we were done, but the idea of social media, if you just had to give like a percentage of how much time you spend on social media in terms of your writing life, what would you say? Because I just want people to dispel the myth that they should be spending a lot of time on social media to be a good writer.
I didn't even open up any social media apps today. I can't look at social media until my writing is done because it's very distracting. So again, my writing always comes first. I don't answer the telephone. I don't bring my phone into my office because everybody's going to have an emergency. I promise you, my mom needs something, my kids need something, and all of it could always wait until after I'm finished. So I don't even do that. How much time do I spend on social media? It's not a lot. If I'm on the road, if I'm on tour, I feel like I'm doing it a little bit more because people like to be in the moment of, oh my gosh, she had a book signing and that sort of thing. But now that I'm sort of quiet and I'm writing, I may post 2 or 3 times a week. I try and keep my story a bit active. And that's really just reposting something else that someone said. But as far as me crafting something, maybe 2 or 3 times a week.
You heard it there, people. Get back to the writing and leave the social media alone. When you get your book deal and you on tour, then you go back on the social media. But until then, get the book out. Work on the book. Do your writing there. Sadiqua, thank you so much. This has been a great, great, great interview. And we wish you all the best of luck on The Beautiful Children. And we'll be anxiously awaiting for it to hit the store shelves.
Oh, Lori, thanks again. And everybody out there, thanks for listening. This was a lot of fun.
Okay, people, didn't that interview leave you feeling so inspired? Like you too can write the stories you were meant to write. I know you can do it.
And like Sadiqua says, why not you? Here are some other takeaways from Sadiqua that can help you on your writing journey. Number one, get your butt in the chair every day. The only way to finish writing a book is to write the book. Every day, put in the time, even if it's only 5 minutes a day. If you let too much time elapse between writing sessions, you'll lose the momentum of the story. Number two, don't rush the process of writing. Your first book is when you're learning how to write, so lean into it and enjoy the process. Your first book is usually the only book you get to write without a deadline or expectations. Remember that. Number three, the thing that scares you is the thing you're supposed to do next. So swallow your fear and do it. Number four, find ways to develop and nurture your talent. Take writing classes. Find a community or writing group to keep you motivated and inspired to write. Join that community or create a writer's group of your own who won't let you quit. And finally, number five, if you want to be a published author, the writing must come first. Put your phone down, skip social media, prioritize the writing, period. Thank you, Sadiqua, for your inspiring advice, your words of wisdom, and for sharing your story with the Read, Write, and Create audience. I hope all of you wordsmiths and sister scribes feel even more encouraged and more motivated to keep writing and to get your stories out into the world. Thank you for listening to this award-winning podcast. If you're looking for more creative writing inspiration and useful resources for your literary life, then be sure to check out the Read, Write, and Create website. That's at readwriteandcreate.com. That's R-E-E-D, writeandcreate.com. And while you're there, don't forget to sign up for the Read, Write, and Create monthly newsletter, which is the first place you'll find out about my latest classes and creative offerings, as well as cool things to optimize and enjoy your literary lifestyle. And let's not forget, even a New York Times bestselling author like Sadiqua Johnson advises writers to find a community to help them stay motivated. I agree 100%. Writing is a solitary activity, but a writing life shouldn't be, which is why I created The Sanctuary, which is a private membership community for BIPOC women writers who want to get published and get paid. I created The Sanctuary to operate somewhere between a gym and a church. You know, we keep our writers in shape and inspired. And we do that by creating things like writing workshops, and we offer co-writing sessions, author visits, beta readers for our work, and continued curated opportunities to get published and get paid. So if you're a BIPOC woman writer who has been searching for a supportive community and accountability for your writing projects, visit the Sanctuary page on the Read, Write, and Create website. The link to apply is in the show notes. The Read, Write, and Create podcast is written and produced by me, Lori L. Tharps. Our editor extraordinaire is Brad Linder. And our theme music is by Wattaboy. I'll be back in 2 weeks on Monday. Until then, keep writing.